Blog Talk Radio.
This is Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean. The show is going to be scheduled sort of short today because of me having to go to Connecticut for a funeral for a very close dear friend. But we're going to start off right away with Lee Morgan, one of the great jazz trumpet players who left us very early, along with Jackie McLean, Hank Mobley, Herbie Hancock, and let's see, I think it was Billy Higgins. So let's give a listen to this fantastic young artist who actually was worked under the tutelage of the great Miles Davis.
Thank you.
That was the great Lee Morgan Quartet doing Cobra. Lee Morgan that was recorded in 1965, and on trumpet, of course, was Lee Morgan, along with Hank Mobley on tenor sax and Herbie Hancock at the piano. All great musicians, all fantastic musicians, as a matter of fact. One of the things that I said I was going to do today is I was going to spend a little time making sure that we gave homage to a fantastic singer and actor. Last week we played one of her songs. She passed away. I'm speaking none other than the great Doris Day, who feared to show up for her own ceremony, facing facts about Doris Day. It's not hard to believe. I just wanted to see if we could find something that she did that really gave an opportunity for you to hear what a beautiful sounding voice that she had. Let's get a listen to see what this is all about.
Born Doris Mary Ann von Kempelhoff on April 3, 1922 in Cincinnati, Ohio, her parents came from German stock. Her father, Frederick Wilhelm von Kempelhoff, was a music teacher, choir master, and church organist, and loved classical music. Her mother, Alma Sophia Welts, on the other hand, was an outgoing woman who enjoyed hillbilly music. Doris was the youngest of three. She had two brothers, Richard, who died before she was born, and Paul, who was a few years older. Doris Day was named after a song. It seems appropriate, given her 21 Billboard Top 10 hits, that Doris Day's stage name would come from a piece of music. She was born Doris Mary Ann Kempelhoff, but the fledgling pop singer was christened Doris Day after a silent movie actress, Doris Kenyon, whom her mother admired. Day wrote this about her mother in her autobiography. "My mother is very barrel house, loves to yak it up and enjoy herself, loves parties, and the more people around, the better." She loves country and western hillbilly music. She could listen to country and western all day long. All through my career, she's asked me, "When are you going to make a country and western movie?" She's in her 70s now, lives with me, and I swear she seems to have as much pep and go as she did when I was a girl. It was big band leader Barney Rapp who convinced her to change her surname, inspired by the song Day After Day, which she sang with the group. Apparently, Doris was never too keen on the moniker, thinking it made her sound too much like a stripper. She didn't know her correct age until 2017. Day thought she would be turning 93 in 2017, but the Associated Press obtained a copy of the actress's birth certificate from Ohio's Office of Vital Statistics, which confirmed that Day was born on April 3, 1922, in Cincinnati, making her actually 95. I've always said that age is just a number, and I have never paid much attention to birthdays, but it's great to finally know how old I really am. Day's age has long been speculated, with various news outlets often estimating her age. We get this question a lot. Looks like we finally have the answer. The story we have heard the most is that at one point, Doris was up for a role when quite young and her age may have been miswritten on the audition form. We don't know if that's correct, but if so, it could have simply stuck for all these years. She briefly dated Ronald Reagan. In her autobiography, Day dishes that she briefly dated Ronald Reagan before he became the president. The two starred together in the 1952 movie The Winning Team. She relayed that Reagan was a skilled dancer and told a biographer he had a political personality because he was engaging and strong, according to People. Day dated Reagan prior to becoming involved with her agent, Marty Melcher, who would become her third husband. A car accident ended her dancing career. As a child, Day was a talented dancer, but in October 1937, at age 15, she was involved in a car accident that seriously injured her legs. She was in a car with friends when a train hit the car, shattering bones in Day's right leg. She shifted her focus to singing instead. In 1956, she famously sang "Que Sera, Sera, Whatever Will Be" in the Alfred Hitchcock thriller, The Man Who Knew Too Much. The song reached number 2 on the American Billboard Hot 100 chart. In this 1956 photo, Doris Day is pictured posing with Frank Sinatra and Lauren Bacall at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. She is mentioned in songs by Wham, Billy Joel, The Beatles, and Elton John. Day's influence in pop music runs well beyond her own impressive discography. The Beatles sang of the BBC, B.B. King, and Doris Day in Dig It. George Michael proclaimed, "You make the sunshine brighter than Doris Day" in the Wham! Smash, "Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go." Billy Joel kicked off his litany of cultural references in We Didn't Start the Fire with Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray. Elton John also rattles off a list of celebrities in Wrap Her Up, toasting Brigitte Bardot, Doris Day, Billie Jean. The actress is also mentioned in songs by Ringo Starr, Dance Giant Underworld, and Dutch ska band Domar, to name a few. She at first refused to sing Que Sera, Sera. Day's signature song almost wasn't. We can perhaps thank Alfred Hitchcock and Paramount Pictures for Day's signature tune. The immortal song was written for the director's 1956 thriller, The Man Who Knew Too Much, which cast Day opposite Jimmy Stewart. Day initially refused to sing the number, deeming it a children's song. Under studio pressure, She reportedly did it in one take and remarked, "That's the last time you'll ever hear that song." The rest is history, and Que Sera Sera became the theme song to her television series. She wasn't a fan of her innocent image. Doris Day's public image was the one role she could never shake off. Day was well known for playing innocent, chaste characters, causing some critics to dub her the world's oldest virgin. The actress addressed this in her 1976 book, Doris Day, Her Own Story, in which she discusses her three failed marriages. Her first marriage to trombonist Al Jordan, with whom she had a son, Terry. Her second marriage to saxophonist George William Wilder. And her third marriage to Martin Melcher, who became her manager. After Melcher died of heart disease in 1968, Day discovered that his failed investments left her deeply in debt. She eventually won a multi-million dollar judgment against their lawyer. She ended up marrying a fourth time to Barry Comden in 1976, but they divorced in 1982. She was afraid of flying. Despite playing a flight attendant in Julie, pictured here, Day dreaded airplanes. The phobia even caused her to turn down some award ceremonies. Day developed a fear of flying back in the 1940s when she accompanied Bob Hope on tours, often in severe weather. Her phobia led her to turn down many appearances and honors, including a tribute at the Kennedy Center, because she didn't want to board a plane. She had a serious health scare in the 50s. In 1956, while Day was shooting the film noir Julie with her co-star and lover, Louis Jordan, doctors discovered a tumor the size of a grapefruit growing in her intestines. After surgery, she made a full recovery. Doris Day was in excellent health till her last days. Day died on May 13, 2019, after contracting pneumonia. Her death was announced by her charity, the Doris Day Animal Foundation. Per Day's request, the foundation announced that there would be no funeral services, grave sites, or other public memorials. Question of the week: could you mention three of her lovers during her life? Leave your answer in the comments, and we will pick a winner in the next week. What do you think of Doris's life? We are waiting for your comments. Drop us a suggestion for future videos.
Yeah, that was Doris Day's life. You didn't get a chance to hear her sing. And therefore, I would like to see if I can pull something up where she did a song when she was playing a part in as a cowgirl, I guess. See if I can find that piece where she performed in it. Yeah, she sang, you know, of course, in Young at Heart with Frank Sinatra. That was the one time I heard it, but this one was from Calamity Jane. Let's see if we can give a listen to that.
Once I had a secret love that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be free. So I turned a friendly star the way that dreamers often do, just a wonderful year. And why I'm so with you. Now I shout it from the highest hill, even though the golden daffodils at last my heart an open door, and my secret love, no secret
great Doris Day. That was recorded in 1953. And to make a long story short, I wanted to just provide us, and those of you out there who are music critics and the like, what a fantastic actor or actress she was. But more importantly, she was a fantastic singer. We're going to move on and listen to some things about drums, jazz drumming. We started last week about that, and we got through three of them. And I'm going to let this gentleman continue to tell you everything about drums. And then when he finishes, I'm going to go back and see if we can find some of those drummers so you can actually hear, in essence, all the things that makes them or made them great, and you can listen to their particular presentation. Here he is.
He invented the modern jazz style with his smooth swinging ride beat. He played in the original. Or he played, was a member of the Count Basie All-American Rhythm Section, and it's just a huge influential figure in the drumming and in jazz. Joe Jones, he later became known as Papa Joe Jones. He's the fourth drummer here. He moved the timekeeping from the bass drum to the hi-hat. Up until that time, they were walking the bass drum on quarter notes, and then he moved that to the hi-hat, which influenced all swing and bop drummers from that time forward. He also worked directly with Avita to define the sound of the hi-hat cymbal, and then he really did a lot to usher in the use of brushes within the jazz form, and he is still considered to be one of the world's best brush players that's ever lived. In his later years, he lived up to his name, Papa Joe Jones. He was very much a mentor to many up-and-coming players. And a great album to check him out on is Joe Jones, The Main Man. Fifth up on the list is none other than the man himself. We all know him, Buddy Rich.
Those are my brand new Ludwig
Crumbs. Mr. Buddy Rich.
All right.
Widely hailed. Again, we heard this with Gene Krupa, but as the world's greatest drummer, many people know him. He was another rock star type drummer. He was known for his power, for his technique, for his finesse. He was also known for his intense work ethic, which sometimes came off as somewhat short or rude, as many of us who have heard recordings of that know. He ran a big band. He also played for a ton of other artists, but he was very well known for running his own big band. He was born into a vaudevillian family. I believe his mother and father were both in the vaudeville. So he was on a stage from around the age of 2 on. He was performing in front of people, and his influence to drumming, he's inspired so many people to pick up the drums as well as inspired the sound of so many drummers. He was also the first American drummer that many British rock drummers heard, and so he inspired players like John Bonham and Bill Ward to begin straying away from the typical 2 and 4 backbeats and put in there some hard-hitting improvisational patterns. And then a great album to listen to for him with some classic Buddy stuff is Big Swing Face. Some of you may not know. Number 6 is Kenny Clarke, and his style really laid the groundwork for all modern jazz drumming. So he was nicknamed Kluke because of one of his signature drum licks. And he was really responsible for moving the timekeeping. Remember, Philly Joe Jones moved it from the bass drum to the hi-hat. So you would have heard Baby Dodd keeping time with that bass drum. Then we have Philly Joe Jones keeping time with that hi-hat on 2 and 4. Now we have Kenny Clarke coming along and bringing that time to the ride cymbal. He was present at the inception of bebop and was also one of its major innovators. Another thing that he did was he would incorporate these hard-hitting bass drum syncopations within that jazz ride cymbal pattern, which we all do nowadays. And at the time, they called them bombs or dropping bombs. His influence was huge on players like Art Blakey, as well as others like Max Roach. A great album to listen to for him is Bohemia After Dark. It features some of the earliest recordings of Cannonball Adderley as well as Nat Adderley. Number 7 is one of my personal favorites. His hands are incredible. You just got to check out the guy's hands and what he does with the sticks. Number 7 is Joe Morello. Now, get this. Joe Morello did the unthinkable. He made a chart-topping song with the Dave Brubeck Group. And here's the thing. It had no vocals, right? It was a jazz tune, so no vocals. Jazz tune. It was also in an on-time signature, and it featured a drum solo. That's right. It's Take 5. He was the drummer on that cut. He was very well known for his melodic soloing, as you can hear on the song Take 5. He was also over 120 recordings. He was a gifted educator as well, publishing several books as well as publishing in the video format. As I've already mentioned, he was a master of drum technique. He was voted Playboy Magazine's Drummer of the Year 7 times in a row. He won Downbeat Magazine, the same Best Drummer of the Year, 5 years in a row, and then he was inducted both into the Modern Drummer Hall of Fame as well as the Percussive Arts Society's Hall of Fame. A great album to listen to him on is the Dave Brubeck Quartet, Time Out, and that actually features the song that I've just been talking about, Take 5. Thank you. Number eight, a lot of you know him, Max Roach. Now, it's been said that what John Bonham did for hard rock, Max Roach did to jazz. He was one of the founders of modern jazz, who was a huge innovator within bebop. Now, we've already heard Kenny Clarke was one of the was really the one that kind of brought about the bebop style of drumming, but Max Roach really took it to that next level. Max viewed himself not only as just the timekeeper, which was kind of the modern view of drummers at that time. He viewed himself as an equal part of the band, and so he was very well known for having these engaging and responsive conversations with the other players through his playing. He had this rock solid pulse and was just a huge mover in the bebop style. He was well known and respected as a band leader and one of the first jazz musicians to teach full time at the college level. Some good albums to listen to would be Clifford Brown and Max Roach's album Study in Brown, as well as Max Roach's album Drums Unlimited, which I believe features the great track The Drum Also Waltzes. I believe that's if I'm remembering correctly. Jones, not to be confused with Papa Joe Jones. Philly Joe Jones came around a little bit later, was a member of the first great quintet, Miles Davis's first great quintet, and it's been said that what Papa Joe Jones did for the rhythm section in the 30s and 40s, Philly Joe Jones did that for the rhythm section in the 50s, right? So that 50s to 60s time, he was very, very influential. Now, for some reason around 1962, some people think that it's because Elvin Jones came on the scene and took some of that limelight. He really kind of fell off the radar after 1962, was still playing, still teaching, but just never on the public level that he was before. He later moved to England and made his mark teaching there, really improving the pool of talent that they had in that area. Fantastic album to listen to Philly's playing on is Miles Davis's album, Milestones. Number 10, one of my favorites, you'll hear me say that a lot, is Art Blakey. Now, Art Blakey, when he was young, came under the tutelage of Chick Webb. He actually was his valet. He took up Chick's hard swinging style and was one of the inventors of the modern bebop style of drumming. You've already heard me refer to Kenny Clarke as well as Max Roach within that bebop style. You have Art Blakey coming up in that tradition as well. He ran his band, the Jazz Messengers, for 35 years, and his incessant to and fro on the hi-hat as well as hard swinging ride pattern were present throughout that group. Now, that group was actually an incubator for many, many sidemen, and that's one of the things that he's very, very well known for, not just being a great player, but also being this mentor to so many people and bringing them into his group and allowing them to grow through the music and over time explore and really develop their sound. I've got these achievements written down. Blakey was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame, the Downbeat Jazz Hall of Fame, the Modern Drummer Hall of Fame, and received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. And really his legacy is not only his music and him as a band leader and him as a drummer, but also him as a mentor and a person to the musicians that played with him. Now, one of my favorite albums is the Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, Moanin, M-O-A-N-I-N. And this really has, to me, one of the perfect examples of a jazz shuffle on it. Blakey just kills it, and his press rolls are the crazy good. Number 11 is the infamous Roy Haynes. He's really the epitome of cool. He was one of the most recorded jazz drummers in history. Haynes had a style that was characterized with Christmas. With finesse, and really just an overall, there's no better way to explain it, cool. He just kind of exuded cool. He had an incredible drive to his playing, and some came to term that or call that hard bop, which later developed into its own kind of subgenre of its own. Haynes helped to pave the way for other well-known drummers like Elvin Jones and Tony Williams. We worked with Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, Stan Getz, Sarah Vaughan, John Coltrane, Chick Corea, Pat Metheny, and a slew of others. A great album to listen to him on, and one of my favorite Chick albums is Chick Corea's Now He Sings, Now He Sobs. Number 12, he's a player that played with Miles Davis, Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, et cetera, and so forth, Jimmy Cobb. Now, he played on what is, many say, is the most popular jazz recording of all time, although I'm not sure that we can really measure that depending on what scale we're measuring that on, and that is Jimmy Cobb, and he played on the album Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. Also of note, he played on Sketches of Spain. The opening track for that is one of my personal faves, but his playing is incredible. He had this insane, just driving quarter note ride cymbal pattern, as well as he was very well known for being able to drive a band with nothing but brushes. Also inducted into the PAS Hall of Fame, some of his influences that he listed were Kenny Clarke, who we heard about earlier, one of the innovators of bebop, as well as Shadow Wilson. He was a drummer for Count Basie. We got Big Sid Catlett, and then Max Roach, also one of the innovators of bebop. Those were some of his influences that he listed. A great album, obviously, to listen to. I've already listed two, but I'll list it again. Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. That was really where I discovered Jimmy's playing. Drummer was stated by Tony Williams as being one of the best drummers in the world. He said there was no argument. It wasn't based upon opinion. It was just fact. And that man is Alan Dawson. Now, many of you may not know Alan Dawson as a player, who he was an insane player. And I've got listed here. He played with, I mean, it's a list of who's who. His recording credits: Lionel Hampton, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, Bill Evans, Charles Mingus, Sonny Rollins. Just an insane lineup. But some of his former students would be John Junior Robinson, Terry Lynn Carrington, Benny Caliuta, Tony Williams himself. At a young age, I believe around 9, began taking from Alan. Alan used to go pick Tony up. He'd drive, 60, 90 miles one way, pick him up, take him to the gig with him, let him kind of see what was going on, then drive him home and get him home safely. This is the kind of influence that this guy had. The reason he's in this list is he didn't just influence the music. He influenced the players. Now, he began teaching at Berklee College of Music around 1957, really never intended on being a teacher, but he found that his playing improved and his teaching improved the longer he did it. So his teaching style really focused on teaching drumming through teaching music. So he really taught players how to play music. He was big about singing the melody while you were playing and learning the form of the tune. He believed that this would give you greater capacity to support the players as well as the song, and the list of drummers that have come through under his tutelage, you can say, yeah, you were probably right. He also took very standard drumming texts like syncopation, Ted Reed's syncopation, and came up with a way to work through many exercises to develop vocabulary within the jazz genre. He actually took everything that was going on in jazz and came up with a systemized way for us to learn it. That's a huge deal. Many of us have gone through that, myself included. I actually have taken from two former Allen Dawson students, both Jeff Mills and Henrique de Almeida. For me, if Tony Williams says it, it must be true. I really do think Allen Dawson is one of the greatest drummers in the world. A great album to listen to him on live was the Dave Brubeck Quartet, The Last Set at Newport.
I'm going to stop right there, mainly because I would like for you to hear one of these people instead of somebody talking about it. And I think that the person that I've chosen for us to listen to is nothing better than the great Art Blakey. And let's pull Art Blakey up. Let's listen to this. This is Tony Williams. To acknowledge some of the great jumpers, of those who are still alive versus those who are no longer with us, like Elvin Jones, who was born in 1927 and passed on in 2004. Joe Morelli was born in 1928 and passed on in 2011. And most people have never heard of either one of them. They never heard of Tony Williams, who was born in 1945 and passed on in 1997. Fantastic musicians. Played with the greatest of musicians and went on to do their own thing later on. You've been listening to Getting It Done, and hopefully you've had an opportunity to learn a little bit about some of these jazz musicians that are no longer with us, but hopefully we can remember them and their accomplishments. I thought it might be nice to finish up the day's work with Mel Lewis and Neil Hefti. This big band and the drums are standout. I don't know if we have enough time to hear the whole thing, but let's give it a shot. Thank you. production that found these guys playing together. Next week, I hope to bring you something of John Petrucelli and maybe a little bit of Count Basie's orchestra. So until then, you are listening to Getting It Done, and have a nice weekend, y'all.